Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour, the voice of Kansas, on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Carl G. We regret to mention anarchist Ed Mead has walked on. In 1974, Ed Mead traveled to San Francisco just a few years after his release from prison for a pharmacy burglary, hoping to connect with the Symbionese Liberation Army. However, when he arrived there, he joined with another group, the New World Liberation Front, where he learned to make pipe bombs. Ed returned to Seattle, where he went underground to begin the armed struggle. He was joined soon after by a friend, Bruce Seidel. They named the group after George Jackson, based on his promise that he would haunt his oppressors after his death. The George Jackson Brigade included a mixture of communist and anarchist ideologies. It was involved in violent acts and advocated the use of force to overthrow the United States government or the government of the state of Washington, trying to initiate a popular insurrection and draw attention to conditions for prisoners at Walla Walla State Penitentiary and an old federal prison on McNeil Island. The main goal of the George Jackson Brigade was the dismantling of the United States government to be replaced with a collectivist form of leadership. Communists and anarchists made up the brigade. The ideas for the exact way this would be achieved were not in uniform. The George Jackson Brigade stated the ruling class would meet any revolution with violence, so they must prepare to use violence themselves. After each attack they carried out, successful or unsuccessful, they would send a communique explaining why each place had been attacked. They also used these communiques as a way to communicate with authorities. In its operations, it tried to avoid killing or injuring civilians at all costs. In various communiques, the group claimed credit for bank robberies, bombings, attacks against custom houses, courthouses, Safeway stores, public utilities, and correctional facilities. Their second attack on the Safeway grocery store at Capitol Hill in Seattle was also their first failure as a group. The group hid a pipe bomb in a 50-pound bag of dog food, which it left in the store. Ed Mead claimed that he then called the Safeway store and informed there was a bomb, but his warning was dismissed as a prank. While the Seattle Press reported he called the wrong number, the explosion injured a number of civilians, engendering criticism of the attack. Prominent members of the George Jackson Brigade included Ed Mead, arrested January 23, 1976 after an attempted bank robbery in Tukwila, Washington. Mead was released from prison in 1993. John Sherman was from New Jersey. He met Mead while they were in federal prison at McNeil Island. Bruce Seidel was a good friend of Mead and graduate student in economics at the University of Illinois. Mark Cook was the organizer of the annual Conference of Prison Activists. He was the only African-American member of the brigade and the last to join. He took part in the Tukwila robbery, avoiding arrest, but was later arrested a few days after later freeing Sherman from Harborview Medical Center, wounding a King County Sheriff's deputy in the encounter. He spent the next 24 years in prison until the year 2000. Rita Bo Brown, a working-class ex-convict from Southern Oregon, active in the Seattle prisoner support community, she was imprisoned for her activities with the brigade. Teresa Kupes, also known as Calico, was Rita Brown's girlfriend from the local area. She also was imprisoned for her activities with the George Jackson Brigade. According to a report published by the National Consortium on the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism for the United States Department of Homeland Security, Science and Technology Directorate, the George Jackson Brigade was ranked 15th among terrorist groups that perpetrated the most terrorist attacks in the United States between the 1970s and 2011. There are two books on the George Jackson Brigade, one of media coverage and the other of the court trials. Ed Mead published a biography called Lumpin' and a second book soon to be in print. You can find Mark Cook's work at Seattle Black Panther Party History and Memory Project at the University of Washington website. After release from prison, Ed Mead spent his last years in rural Oregon. So this is the ballad of Ed Mead from people who wrote letters to prisoners and who knew him back in Chicago. At the time of the writing of this song, anarchists and prison solidarity folks thought that 2015 was the last summer of Ed Mead, but he hung on for 8 more years.
Love you, Ed Mead. Friend bound to in prison. The Scorpio dude at the door just forget. It was 1975, not a man or woman alive will ever repair. Love and me set their word. Inside the walls, we got the news today. The friends of Ed Mead hold heavy heart, but he'll never go away. From the Monroe prison to the walls of Walla Walla, at McNeil Island, the rock and the soul fighter, the underground insurgent blew up the residence of the Department of Corrections. He made a little mess. Inside the walls, we got the news today. The friends of Ed Mead hold heavy hearts, but he'll never go away. Remember drinking beer on top of a downtown roof and talk about bombing gear and how the building went poof. He would shake and he would laugh, passionate about his craft. He'd look at you with those crazy eyes, but the fucker was actually quite nice. Inside the walls, we got the news today. The friends of Ed Mead hold heavy hot, but it never go away. Shit was real fucked. Things were not okay. So we placed an order for contraband to wipe that shit away. Armed with a pipe shotgun, time to get off the dime. Man against sexism, had some fun. Inside the walls, we got the news today. The friends of Ed Mead hold heavy hearts, but he'll never go away.
Perfect.
The Preamble of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW.org. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people and the few who make up the employing class. The employing class have all the good things in life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands make the trade unions unable to cope with ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one to set workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class had interests in common with other employers. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry or in all industries, if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one, an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. Knowing therefore that such an organization is absolutely necessary for emancipation, we unite under the following set of guidelines. The St. Paul Principles from neighborhoodanarchist.org. Our solidarity will be based on the respect for a diversity of tactics and the plans of other groups. The action and tactics used will be organized to maintain a separation of time or space. Any debates or criticisms will stay internal to the movement, avoiding any public or media denunciation of fellow activists and events. We oppose any state repression of dissent, including surveillance, infiltration, disruption, and violence. We agree not to assist law enforcement actions against activists and others. Public infighting and policing of tactics divide the movement and does the state work for them. When we allow space for all tactics, we are stronger, we are larger. We are unified in purpose, and the powers that be are the most challenged to hold us back. Security culture is a set of shared customs for a community whose members may be targeted that are designed to minimize risk, to offset paranoia, and to increase effectiveness and trust. These intentional practices can become habitual and instinctive. Security culture principles. The central principle is that people should never be aware of sensitive information they do not need to know. Don't ask, don't tell. The greater the number of people who know something that can put a project at risk, the more chance there is of it getting into the wrong hands. Security culture involves a code of silence, but it is not a code of voicelessness. It should preserve as much secrecy as is necessary for individuals to be safe in their activities while still organizing effectively. Learn and abide by the security expectations of each person you interact with and respect differences in style. Ask people to outline for you their specific security needs and let others know yours. You say no at any time to anyone about anything. Don't answer questions or participate in any projects you don't feel good about. Look out for other people. Don't imperil others with your decisions. Don't brag about past actions. Remember, jokes can be taken seriously. Don't throw any direct action ideas around in public that you think you might want to try at some point. Brainstorm with trusted individuals. Develop methods to establish the security level of a group or situation. People who understand the importance of good security will not feel insulated if asked to lead the sensitive conversation. Meeting location is an important factor in security. Consider the risks. Don't get too distracted worrying about whether people are infiltrators or not. If your security measures are effective, it shouldn't even matter. Keep sensitive information inside the circle of people it concerns. Collaborate with reliable and experienced comrades whose history you can verify. And don't give away anything about your private activities. This is the Abolitionist Hour, the voice of Kansas on Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Carl G.
Here's a news flash for all you boppers. The Turnbull ACs missed their chance, so the opportunity's still there for a big hit. More news later.
The helicopter was in the area from that same crash, so the helicopter was also able to relay information down to the men on the ground and their cars.
Well, we are being joined in studio by Sarah DeVolcanaire. She is the wife of Eric DeVolcanaire, KCPD detective, who had his prison sentence upheld last week following the shooting of Cameron Lamb in 2019. We've kind of set the stage for how we got to the shooting of Cameron Lamb, Sarah. So let's just start off and, I mean, get right to the gun portion of this. There is this narrative per the prosecutor that the gun found at the scene alongside Cameron Lamb was a planted gun.
But speaking of stolen items, the gun that he was in possession of was also stolen. And yes, you're right, there have been all these conspiracy theories about a planted gun, which to me seems crazy and asinine, but there are sadly people out there that believe this. He knew he never touched it, and our attorneys and Eric requested that the analysis be run and it was tested for DNA. And, you know, lo and behold, of course, it came back with Cameron's DNA on the exterior of the gun, but it's also very important to note that DNA was also on the magazine and on the bullets inside the gun.
Now, what about, because the other insinuation that came out of this was that Cameron Lamb was right-handed and that he didn't have full use of his left hand, and therefore a gun found in the car along his left side, first off, it fed into the conspiracy of a planted gun, and it also said, well, you know, I mean, you know, he couldn't even use that weapon with his left arm.
Yes, and so when you hear that, I too, when I first heard that, I'm sure people are imagining this, you know, mangled hand situation, and how can this be? Well, when we got the medical records and I saw photos, the hand injury was actually caused by a gunshot wound to his hand, and it affected just the very tip of his finger, like maybe half of your fingernail. So he had full use of it. There was, during the trial, there was like a montage of videos and pictures of Cameron Lamb shooting guns in the air, using both hands to work on cars, and full use of hands. And so that is absolutely not true. We also had an expert orthopedic surgeon review his medical records and determine that he would have had full use of his hands.
So this happened. What else from that scene, from that moment, do you feel, I mean, this is stuff that I think most people in Kansas City probably didn't know and haven't heard, but what else has been missed from that moment and that shooting and what took place that you want to make sure Kansas City knows?
You know, I just think that sometimes people think, well, this was just some poor random guy backing into the garage to work on a car, and that is not the case. And as I told you today, he was involved in, you know, dangerous activity on the road, just speeding and running lights. And I think people think too.
We have an enthusiastic crowd. It's great. At the Center for Palestine Studies, and Mariam is hopefully watching us in Lebanon. I also want to thank my colleagues, Brinkley Messick and Rashid Khalidi, especially for their special dedication to this event. But we're also grateful to all the staff and volunteers that you've seen around here who've generously offered their time and talents. And it's a tribute to our speakers that so many units enthusiastically joined us as co-sponsors. the Institute for Research in African American Studies, the Institute for Research on Women and Gender, the Middle East Institute, the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race, the Hyman Center for the Humanities, the Anthropology Department, the Center for International History, and the Institute for Comparative Literature and Society. Thank you all. Now, we've all done our parts because we want to honor Edward Said's memory and his legacy. And I want to acknowledge especially his daughter, Nejla Said, who's here tonight representing the whole family. This is not the first event in his honor, nor will it be the last, but we think it's quite special, and I'm glad that you all thought so too. Edward Said taught at Columbia for 40 years, and we feel individually and as a community that we're part of his legacy at this university and in the world. Cornell West is now teaching across the street at Union Theological Seminary, and Judith Butler is teaching here in the Department of English and Comparative Literature. And this is a university that showed great integrity when Edward was alive in upholding the principles of both academic freedom and free speech. The university protected the right of this extraordinary figure to be both a deep and original scholar and a public intellectual. And I want to share just one personal memory. At Edward's funeral at Riverside Church 10 years ago, I felt sad as the large crowd, hushed and deeply moved by Daniel Barenboim's exquisite piano offering, walked down the aisle to leave the church. And I found myself walking near my dear colleague, Mahmoud Mamdani. I told him that I felt this marked the passing of a generation. Who would now speak for us? Iqbal Ahmed had passed away in 1999 at the Asia Society here in New York. Edward and my father, along with Dan Berrigan and many others, had mourned and celebrated this most charismatic, politically sharp, and beloved figure. 2 years later, my father passed away in Palestine. Edward walked alongside us in Jaffa with some other people in this room in May 2001 behind the coffin of his dear friend. And now, 2 years later, Edward Said. And I'll never forget what Mahmoud said. It's now up to you. But who among our generation could measure up? I thought then. And I think tonight on this platform, two of the most remarkable people of this generation have stepped forward, carrying the mantle, but speaking in their own distinct voices and from their own standpoints. Their critiques of injustice are clear and principled, their moral vision is exemplary, and their intellectual brilliance is unquestioned. Like Edward Said, they are teachers and scholars of huge distinction, and like him, they're at the same time public figures who speak out courageously about the major political and social issues of our time. Now, in talking about his work on the question of Palestine, Edward explained, is a quote, "I've been unable to live an uncommitted or suspended life. I've not hesitated to declare my affiliation with an extremely unpopular cause," unquote. Now, what I admire so much about Judith Butler and Cornell West is they're the same. They do not live uncommitted lives. They're intellectuals and philosophers who've shaped how we think about power, gender, race, injustice, and the value of human life, and they've not been afraid to think and talk about the situation of Palestinians, the consequences of Zionism, the violent policies of the Israeli state, and the links between forms of domestic and international injustice. They have affiliated with an unpopular cause. They didn't have to. But in doing what we New Yorkers are urged to do all the time now, if you see something, say something, I think they've given many more people that ability to see and to speak, and I'm talking about the next generation. So for me, these are two moral and intellectual giants of our generation, and I know they're not the same height, but I've admired them since I first met them, both coincidentally in Princeton around 25 years ago. And I'm so grateful on behalf of the Center for Palestine Studies and everyone else for their generosity in accepting our invitation to come talk with us and to each other. I know you're here because you want to know, because you know who they are and you want to hear them. So I won't go into their accomplishments. You have a little flyer with bios. But to get help get the conversation started, I will turn things over now to James Shamus. Familiar to some as a brilliant film theorist and professor at Columbia, some as a producer who's been keeping serious cinema alive, and to others as a screenwriter and longtime collaborator in the good sense of Ang Lee, who's joined us tonight too. He's also on the faculty of the Center for Palestine Studies. So please join me in welcoming Judith Butler, Cornel West, and James Shamus to talk about Palestine and the public intellectual in honor of Edward Said.
This one is called World War III, a prophecy. No more racial struggle. No more cultural war. 'Cause only a cultural revolution can prove what we are fighting for. Each one has his own culture, and different from all others. But right here on earth, my friend, we all should live as brothers and sisters, you know? Some people fancy an Afro hairdo, while others keep their hair. This, as far as society goes, is normal, clean and fair. But when you grow your locks so long, until it locks and looks so dreadful, people look you from the soles of your feet and stomp the crowns on your head. Cultural war. Everything has its time, my friend, and everything has its season. But right now we are fighting and fighting and fighting, and still we don't know the reason. So let's be fair and serious and get this thing down straight. We are all brothers and sisters and should never live in hate. No more racial struggle, no more cultural war. 'Cause only a revolution can prove what we are fighting for. Each one has his own culture and differ from all others. But right here on this earth, my friend, we are all sisters and brothers. Some people fancy an Afro hair too. Others cream their hair. This, as far as society goes, seems normal, clean and fair. But when you grow your locks so long, until it locks and looks so dead, they look you up from the soles of your feet and calm the crown on your head. Everything has its time. Everything has its season. But we're fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting, and still we don't know the reason. So let's be fair and serious and get this thing down straight. We are brothers and sisters and should not live in hate. World War I came and gone, World War II just before I was born. But today, all I can say, World War III is just a minute away.
Good evening, and thanks, Lila. Let me briefly lay out the format for tonight's event. meditate a bit on some of the questions its title might suggest to our speakers and commence with the first question. Let's begin by acknowledging that this was a very hot ticket, and more on that in a second, and that tonight we are in, to borrow a phrase both from Israeli jurisprudence and from Judith Butler's recent work, a lot of absent presences. So while we will solicit questions to supplement and continue tonight's conversation, we're going to do so virtually in the hope that those of you not sitting with us in the library will feel the connection we here certainly feel with you. Or post to our Facebook event page, Judith Butler and Cornel West in Conversation by the Center for Palestine Studies at Columbia University. If, however, the conversation feels like it can continue uninterrupted, I'll hold fire and ask all of your forgiveness in advance if we entertain few, if any, questions. So some preliminaries to an initial question prompted by the subtitle of tonight's event, Palestine and the Public Intellectual Honoring Edward Said. I'll briefly break down some of those constituent parts and in preface to the conversation it announces. First, honoring Edward Said. This evening takes place as one of a wonderful number of events commemorating Edward Said, and as such it prompts, if not begs, the question as to the uses and reasons for those commemorations, honorifications, memorializations, and celebrations. A couple of weeks ago in Lerner Hall, Edward Said was remembered. Last week, his memorial lecture was delivered. Tonight, he is honored. It is appropriate under such circumstances to ask whether and how his memory is working and how it should be working. Now, how's it working for us, for you? One use, of course, arises for the simple conjunction of the name Edward Said with the word Palestine. And here, I feel the need to try to articulate a specific and particular sense of excitement about tonight's conversation. Let's face facts. Each of tonight's interlocutors alone is, to use the language of celebrity, which raises its own questions but also feels somewhat appropriate tonight, a hot ticket. But together, in conversation, present to each other, this does feel like a moment, an event. And the territory, occupied or otherwise, where they come together tonight is, well, Palestine. Tonight, it feels as though, unlike perhaps in Edward Said's day, it is not the question of Palestine. Rather, it is Palestine that is asking the questions. Indeed, Palestine is demanding answers. The feeling of that feels, if I can put it that way, significant and exciting. Then we have this word public. What is a public, or to ask the question another way, what do publics do, and what might they be doing here tonight? Well, unlike, let's say, proletariats or peoples or communities or masses or plebes, publics seem mainly to have opinions. Or we could say have opinions ascribed to them. But for Edward Said, though, the word public always held out the promise of its Enlightenment origins as the site of public reason, as a place where genuine truths can emerge. That's why for Said, there is no need for the category of public intellectual, for the intellectual is, by his definition, always public, someone who publishes, who comes into being as such by making representations to a public. As he writes in his wonderful volume, Representations of the Intellectual, there's no such thing as a private intellectual. The intellectual, he says, quote, is an individual endowed with a faculty for representing, embodying, articulating a message, a view, an attitude, philosophy, or opinion to, as well as for, a public. To, as well as for. The intellectual represents, paradoxically teaching her public something, in a sense, it already knows, but just doesn't know that it knows, teaching it, in the Saidian version, the unknown truth about what it really is. It's a strange role that requires the intellectual to come into being wholly in relation to the public, but to not be the public or even part of the public, to be a representing representation. For Said, the intellectual stands outside, and mainly, again, with a nod to his Enlightenment heritage, because, as Said writes, the intellectual speech is always on behalf of universal principles. The weight of that universal burden makes the intellectual anything other than the usual expert sent out to manage the public through his or her expertise. Said's intellectual paradoxically maintains the social prestige and authority of the intellectual class, but is, as he puts it, someone who cannot easily be co-opted by governments or corporations and whose raison d'etre is to represent all those people and issues that are routinely forgotten or swept under the rug. And here you see another paradoxical dialectical leap in Said's thinking. The public that the intellectual is to represent to the public is actually the abjected, the forgotten, the oppressed. That is to say, outsiders, whose outsiderness is mimicked by the intellectual, but now from a position of authority, if not of power. heavy burdens to bear, which is no doubt why Said constantly references the intellectual's, well, crankiness. Least of all, he writes, quote, should an intellectual be there to make his or her audiences feel good? The whole point is to be embarrassing, contrary, even unpleasant. It's as if for Said, the repulsion felt by the proper public for those habitually abjected and excluded must, if only as a moment of negative pleasure, be felt also in the presence of the intellectual. I think I speak on behalf of tonight's public when I say how excited I am to be here to listen in on what will I know will be, in honor of Edward Said, a truly embarrassing, contrary, and unpleasant conversation. And let's start it by asking, as we've asked about what memorializations do, what publics do, what intellectuals do, and what Palestine does, a simple question you need entertain only by ignoring it. What actually are we doing here tonight?
Well, it's not the option. Hear me, told you. Word couldn't be louder than action. Could I never? War is not the option. What a matter. Word couldn't be louder than action. War is not the option. Word couldn't be louder than action.
Yeah.
It's like the leader said best. All them promoting struggle and stress. War is not one of the world in a mess. Revelation of the deal and them giving us less. Some go with promoting.
How are we doing?
I'm just blessed to be here with you, my dear sister, and to keep the focus on the rich legacy and the witness that Edward Said was able to bear, trying to tell the truth in the best of his fallible yet creative ability, and yet at the same time to inspire so many of us.
It's true.
Inspire so many of us. What do you think we're doing?
Hard to hear?
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It's interesting. I was thinking about the fact that we are memorializing and we're honoring. And yet, it seems to me that for the most part, when we talk about Edward Said's work, we speak in the present tense.
Mm.
And we have to, because it's a work that was written more than a decade ago, ceased to be written a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it acts on us, and we read it, and it has informed. It's not only in our present time, but it's given us, I think, a new sense of what present time might be, how we tell the story of this time, how we understand ourselves in time. And to honor him is in part to memorialize him, but
perhaps there's a counter-memorializing that happens not by dishonoring him, but by allowing the work to live in the present as we take it up and rethink it for our own time or for our various times. One thought I have is that there was a point in his work where he insisted that when we look at literature, and especially when we look at representations of Palestine or representations of dispossession or exile, forcible exile, that we have to pay attention to the form. And he said it must be fragmentary, it must be partial. There's no single narrative we can tell. There's no single motif we can tell. And that it must interrupt certain dominant narratives. It must have the power to interrupt certain dominant narratives. And that's interesting because it opens up the question of, if we think about the founding of Israel in 1948 or the incremental forms of settler colonialism that were already in place prior to 1948 that were in some sense the precondition of that founding. How do we tell that story? And how can that story be taught? How is it taught? And of course, one crucial point he made is that the story of that founding rests upon the forcible dispossession and exile of nearly 900,000 people. The number of Palestinian exiles in his time was, he gathered about 4 million, and now it's estimated to be 5. Mm-hmm. And that includes, of course, subsequent expulsions and dispossessions. But how is it that we tell the story of that founding and also tell the story of the Nakba? Can they be told at the same time? Can they be told together? Are we yet ready to think about the link between that founding and not only the radical dispossession of that time, but a continuing dispossession and a continuing injustice that has not been acknowledged internationally, that has not been addressed adequately, that continues as a traumatic feature of our present?
Mm-hmm.
Two questions of time. How do we tell the one story with the other? How do we link them? How do we grasp that link? How do we understand that that's not just something that happened in history, but that it pervades the historical time in which we live?
Everybody wants to live together. Why can't we live together? Hey, gotta live, gotta live, gotta live, gotta live, gotta live together. Gotta live, oh, oh, oh. Gotta live, gotta live together. Gotta live, gotta live together. What color, ooh, you're still my brother. No matter, no matter what color, ooh, you're still all my brother. Yeah, everybody wants to live together. Why can't we live together? Gotta live together.
Gotta live, gotta live.
Be okay. But so let's talk for a moment about secular humanists. You know, I didn't know Edward, and I thought back on why it is I did not know him.
You'd have a wonderful conversation.
Maybe so, maybe not. What's interesting to me, we did email briefly when we were both angry at Lawrence Summers for his ridiculous claim that to criticize Israel is effectively to be anti-Semitic. And so we had a little virtual solidarity at that moment, but it was not very far before he died. But I was thinking that at the time, say in the 90s especially, you know, there were people who were humanists, and then there were post-structuralists, or
right. There
were people who were secularists, and then there were the rest of us who didn't really know, or maybe had some questions about that term. And so we didn't come into conversation for kind of petty literary critical reasons, right? Which now seem rather petty to me because I just am not having those conversations in that way. So I went back and I thought to myself, what work does secular do for Said, and what work does humanist do? Why those terms? Why did he feel he needed them? What work did they do that no other term could do? Or and I found the following, which was very interesting to me. First of all, when he talks about the secular, he tends to oppose it to what he calls fundamentalisms, mm-hmm. or to religion understood as the demand for theocratic rule. Theocratic rule. Okay. Well, okay. I understand that. He opposed secular nationalists, interestingly. So secular must have a critical relationship to nationalism, right? And starting to understand a little bit about what it does. But what it seems to do more often than not is to name possibilities of connection or translation among exiled peoples, right? Mm. He wanted to hold out for that. And he made the claim, I think it was indirectly a claim about Jews in relation to Israel, but it has a more general applicability, that when we, any of us, represent our oppression, our dispossession, our forcible exile, the slaughters committed against us, that we have to not only make that representation clear, but also turn it around and ask for whom else is that happening? Has that happened? And also, have I or have we, this people who have suffered, also caused a suffering for others? And what responsibility do we take for it? And you had to ask those two questions. Who am I linked with in my oppression? And have I myself become an oppressor inadvertently or deliberately, thinking that my historical victim status makes it definitionally impossible for me to oppress others? Okay, so those were kind of two obligations that he understood as obligations of the secular, interestingly enough, which suggested that there was a certain dislocation of the first person perspective that has to happen within what he calls the secular. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there are all kinds of ways to bring religion into that picture. We could all agree on that. We could all agree that those are values. The translation among exiled peoples, the self-reflective moment, what have I myself done? Not only what have I suffered, what have we suffered, but what have we done? How do I put those together? How do I keep those two histories from being delinked systematically, right? Which is part of the history of pre- and post-Zionism. And you know, there's a moment, I believe it's in Representations of the Intellectual, where he refers to Hanan Ashrawi's dissertation, which I didn't know about. And there she claims that the Palestinian people are those whose national experience belongs with that of, meaning alongside or juxtaposed with, belongs alongside that of the Armenians, the Jews, the Irish, the Cypriots, the American blacks, the Poles, the American Indians, at those terrifying frontiers where the existence and disappearance of peoples fade into each other, where resistance is a necessity, but where there is also sometimes a growing realization of the need for an unusual and to some degree an unprecedented knowledge. And this was for Said a moment to which he returned time and again. So when he says, I'm the last of the Jewish intellectuals, it's like, yes, but maybe he's the last of the Armenian intellectuals, or maybe he's the last of the black intellectuals. In other words, it's not just Palestinian and Jew, it's a way of thinking the Palestinian historical experience in some kind of conjunction. Not to say that they're structurally the same, or to posit an equivalence, but to say that there's some kind of affiliation, solidarity, demand for translation that emerges in and through that kind of juxtaposition. Now, I will sign on that. I will say yes, I will sign on that. I don't know if that makes me a secularist to say that, But for him, it does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he put much weight on the secular in that regard.
This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it would be nothing. Nothing here without a woman or a girl. Make the call to take us over the road. Make the train to carry a heavy load. Man made the electric light down to take us out of the dark. Man made a boat for the water, like to say, Noah made the eye. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. About a little bitty baby girl and a baby boy. Man makes them happy calls. Man makes them toys. And after man makes everything he can, he makes that money. The Bible of a man. You see, this is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl.
And then the irony of those Jewish brothers and sisters of conservative bent and centrist bent. We're not talking about Jewish radicals. We're not talking about Jewish communists. We're not talking about Jewish left-wingers. Jewish conservatives and centrists in 1948 who engage in a discourse that hides and conceals the suffering of precious Palestinians as they undergo dispossession, as they undergo expatriation, as they undergo occupation after 67, to this very day, at this very moment, a level of very, very vicious form of colonization.
But I guess I would just add that it's also the liberal Zionist Jewish community which keeps that that keeps that narrative in place. So it's not just conservative and right.
Well, for me, liberals are centrists these days.
Okay, yeah. Liberals are centrists. But also, interestingly enough, some of the writings that supported the kibbutz movement also were solidly within settler colonialism.
No, that's true.
You know,
that's
Gabriel true. Peterberg, I think, lays that out in a pretty convincing way. So we have to wonder about what it is to think about Zionism, perhaps, even in some of its left-wing modes.
Absolutely.
As being complicit with settler colonialism, even on the left, even what is called the left. And one of
absolutely.
The discursive problems we've got, right, is what do we call the left? Who's left?
That's right. Who's left of the left?
What's left of the left?
That's right.
But also what gets to be called the left, which is still maybe part of a colonial project. And that's where I think he thought intellectuals should come to the fore. He called it marshaling a certain kind of realism, alertness. He was especially enraged by inconsistency and uncareful thinking,
so that we
don't simply take some of these political designations as givens. We have to ask what work they do, what effacements they perform.
Absolutely.
Well, it's just that when I finally understand what he wants the terms to do, I tend to agree with him. I'm just
about agency and
the agent, the Vico, I think is really quite amazing. I think I would have a little bit of struggle with it. Do we just create ourselves?
Right.
Or do we just produce ourselves? I think not. I think we are produced very often by forces we don't really have a lot of control over. And I think there's a kind of tragic structure to subject formation that that needs to be thought. We're formed in history, we're formed in language and culture and power, we're formed in traditions. We don't get to choose our parents. We don't get to very often choose many things about the circumstances, and not just the circumstances of our birth, but the very sense of who we are and the sense of the world. And then you struggle within it. You struggle within it to find your place and to make of yourself what you can. But there's, how do we think about that struggle? He was in a different position. He was worried explicitly and always about the fading of the history of Palestine, the fading of Palestinian culture, the pushing of Palestine into oblivion, that it would become, it would be something that no one would remember, or that there would be no way to install the memory, to archive it, to insist on it. And so oblivion was what he was fighting against, right? And being able to remake that history was also a way of giving himself a ground, being able to make sure that history remained alive. And I think that's really, really important. But I think sometimes we're born into traditions that overwhelm us or encumber us or against which we have to struggle. And I think probably my own struggle with my own Zionist and Jewish formation has been one of those. I mean, the question of Palestine actually made me have to think very reflectively about what I was born into and what I was taught and how the world was told to me, what story of the world I was given. And I had to think twice about who are those people who told me that story and why were they doing that and what story do I now want to tell or how do I want to interrupt that one, which is right at the heart of the liberal Jewish political world. So let me just say this, though. What I like and what I need, I mean, it's so funny that we were on different sides of a certain kind of intellectual spectrum, but now I don't think I can think without him. Sorry, I didn't get to tell you.
What's the situation? Only you.
But what I get from him, especially reading about his own experiences, being attacked or being called anti-Semitic or people saying vile and hideous things against this elegant, brilliant, erudite, reasonable person, right? Deeply reasonable person, is that he says that the intellectual, who is, yes, always a public intellectual in the sense that when we publish, we're in the world and we put our stuff out there and we are exposed, who knows what's coming back or not coming back. It's a risk, he says. You have to reconcile the demands of your own self with the public demands upon you.
Mm.
And that was helpful to me. And he talks about alertness as a kind of virtue of the public intellectual, or the intellectual who is trying to respond to a certain kind of public demand or public situation. He uses the word vulnerability. He doesn't use the word courage so much, but he was courageous.
Oh, yeah.
And whatever that struggle was to continue to speak out and to say what he had to say, even though he was being viciously attacked and people were trying to demean him, just as we know, Palestinian professors here at Columbia who try to do scholarship on Palestine have also been shamelessly attacked. How does one emerge from the attack? How does one fend it off? I mean, you said you don't care that people called you anti-Semitic. Well, I don't know. I bet you cared a little.
As long as the bullets didn't fly.
Yeah. But don't you kind of feel like the bullets are just right behind that? I mean, are they that far behind?
I've been called worse, though.
I do hear what you're saying. I just restate it. I said, there's nothing particularly anti-Semitic by also taking issue with Zionism as opposed, in addition to the occupation, which is really, I felt like the history to which he was really returning to, like telling that history again and again, in the 40s and in the 50s and what that meant for displacement and for the stealing of land. What I loved about the fact that he got so viciously attacked, I mean, I hate the fact that he got viciously attacked and that these vicious attacks continue still. But what I appreciate is that he seemed to get calmer and more rational, right? He just went back. He said, okay, let's take the argument apart. Let's move carefully. Let's be more careful. Let's be more precise. Let's talk about it historically. Let's talk about it conceptually. Mm-hmm. Let's use some counterexamples.
Mm-hmm.
Let's write with absolute persuasive lucidity. I don't know. I don't know how to fathom it. But it's a great thing, and it is perhaps a kind of virtue. I don't think we can mime it or follow it. I mean, it was his, but we have to kind of ask that question of ourselves: how do we take those risks and not become a purveyor of or a deodorized discourse, not become a kind of pure professional who cares only about professional standing, or who won't risk one's reputation by speaking what one knows to be true and unjust.
Right.
Maybe it's also important to remember that there were those important editorials that he was writing in the Al-Ahram weekly and that those tended to be really very concrete about political initiatives, what was happening on the ground, what political parties were doing, who the brokers were, what the stakes were, and that seemed to be a different kind of writing, right?
Yes.
He was very, very, very obviously attuned to the concrete political terms of the struggle at that point.
I
something about exile. You know, at one point he says, exile is a concrete condition. It's also a metaphor. Okay. Yeah. In other words, it is this particular people dispossessed. But first of all, we have to ask the question, does it adequately or equally embrace Palestinians with damaged rights within the Israeli state currently? Does it describe well Palestinians living under occupation in the West Bank or Gaza, or in Gaza, which I consider to be a kind of, you know, under siege, maybe a continuation of occupation by other means? Do those communities, or those and then those who are intellectuals in New York, is it the same as being in a refugee camp in the south of Lebanon? Or I just think maybe I'm not sure exile can do all that work. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it can do all that work well. Mm-hmm. And when it's both a condition and a metaphor, it's also not just the condition of Palestinians, let's remember, but the link between the Palestinians and the native peoples and the Jews and the Cypriots and the African Americans and all the others he's willing to list there, at which point it's doing a whole lot of work.
Oh, that's true.
And then, the other question is, so where's belonging? Where's belonging? There's always a longing to belong. But what about communities in which belonging is being reproduced all the time? Right. And he does say that in After the Last Sky. I mean, especially some of those photographs of people in their domestic spaces continuing to lay the table and continuing to go through the rituals of everyday life that consolidate a certain kind of tradition and history and set of connections. But at the political level, what kind of forms of belonging are they? And if he's against certain kinds of nationalism, how do we think about belonging to the Palestinian nation across these various scattered zones? If it's not a nationalism, is there another language for it? Would have been interesting to push those questions about
crucial,
belonging and solidarity.
Crucial question.
So we got about 15 minutes, and I hold in my hand some questions. And just a reminder to those of you out there who might want to drop one in the next couple minutes, at CU Palestine. Hashtag Edward Said. A question maybe to shift into the present, because it's been a remarkable journey and time spent. As you said, we speak of him in the present tense, but it's inevitable that we've been looking backwards too. There's a question that says, can you address how to translate this debate into action? Should we be concerned, or how should we be concerned with activism?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one point in Edward's writings when he says, that he gives lectures sometimes, and then people stand up and at the end and they say, what should we do? And he writes, I refuse to answer that question. Because he didn't think it was the proper purview of the intellectual. He understood the intellectual to be causing discomfort, trying to point out inconsistencies, trying to produce different frameworks, checking the facts, making the argument, elucidating it. So I think that what he didn't like was the idea that an intellectual should be in the place of the ruler, and he says this, and he worries about how the discourse of rule has saturated the intellectual, right? So if we sit up here and go, okay, everybody, here are the five things we need you to do, right, and then send you on your way, what kind of position are we in at that moment? Well, I mean, I have obviously several, we both have clear political commitments that one could track. But I think one has to sort of, respectfully resist the question. Mm. I'm going to get in trouble for that, aren't I?
No.
I can see it now.
Yeah.
You got to be strong or else they will trample you to death.
American government has functioned in such a way that it has not just hidden and concealed the suffering, but helped reproduce it in more intense ways. And as American citizens who are concerned about truth, and Adorno used to say, what, the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. Everybody's suffering, anybody's suffering. We have a fundamental role to tell the truth about the role of America as the kind of broker of deceit that it has been. That's contrary to what happened in March 1945 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt told the head of Saudi Arabian Empire, we will not proceed unless we check with you and we'll do nothing hostile to Arabs. That's March 1945 on the way from Yalta. And every president has violated that. So it's a matter of trying to get that truth out. Honestly, in organized ways. A crucial role will be played by the young Jewish brothers and sisters who are willing to tell the truth vis-a-vis your mamas and your daddies. That you refuse to live in an empire, in a democratic experiment that does not treat other human beings with dignity and decency in our name. That's true for the Philippines, it's true for Guatemala, it's true for the West Bank, it's true for Ethiopia too. But we're talking about Palestine. So in that sense, Edward was saying, I'm not going to tell you one thing to do.
I agree.
I'm not going to tell you two things to do.
I agree.
Understand what is happening and what is being done in your name.
Mm-hmm.
And your refusal to allow it to happen to the best of your ability, whatever form it takes.
Mm-hmm.
As a filmmaker, as a poet, as an artist, as a sanitation worker, whatever mm-hmm. it is, whatever form.
I guess I would just add one thing here, which is that, it's interesting that we are two non-Palestinians up here who are addressing the issue of the public intellectual, but we have to make sure that the absence of the Palestinian is not a condition of legitimacy, right? So the real question for me is, what are we hearing from Palestine? What are people in Palestine asking us to do? Is there a call to us? Is there a request? Are there ways of making solidarity with, say, the prisoner solidarity movement? The prisoner solidarity movement. I mean, I noticed that there was a solidarity between prisoners in Palestine in Pelican Bay.
Absolutely.
That was
California.
That was a moving,
very
interesting
so.
Solidarity.
Very
actually
so.
One that was initiated by the Palestinian prisoner organizations. What's the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement asking us to do? What are they telling us about how our institutions are complicit with the reproduction of the occupation or the sanitization of Zionism more generally?
Yes, yes.
How do we respond to that call?
How do we respond to that call?
We don't want to be over here deciding what's the best thing to do for Palestine, right? Then we're technocratic intellectuals who are divorced from a democratic struggle, from a struggle for self-determination,
right?
From the outside, if you're going to decide what Palestine should do, then you're undercutting self-determination, and Palestine hasn't yet had self-determination. You know, that's the least we can do is hear, read what it is that is being asked of us, and make judgments about it. Surely,
absolutely.
You know, we don't just like
no,
oh, okay, anything.
Like,
no,
no,
okay, anything.
No,
no,
no.
make judgments about what we can do, how we can respond, what's the ethical and political call, and how does it resonate with me, and what can I do from within my position or from within my institution, within my religious institution, within my my family. And
two other questions that are somewhat linked, and they refer, I think, at least for me, back to that astonishing quotation from Mashrawi's dissertation, the last word of which was very surprising to me, when she talks about this collective sociocide and both bio and cultural death of all of these various folks over history, and ends with that this leads her to an unprecedented, and the word she used was knowledge.
Yeah.
Because I was waiting for unprecedented something, and knowledge was a surprise, actually, and a great one. Two questions. One's pretty depressing. Hasn't Palestinian culture already gone into oblivion? The other, connected to it, though. How should Palestinians connect their suffering to the suffering of others? What is the role of allies? I think we've already addressed some of that in your most recent remarks.
It's funny, I have to overcome my temptation to be slightly rude in relation to the question, and I feel like maybe you could take it.
I think rudeness has a role, has a role.
I mean, first of all, what we mean by Palestinian culture, I mean, it certainly has, if you go to Palestine, it is not a place of oblivion. It is an active, interesting place where people are arguing with each other a lot and making excellent food and doing many other things in life. So, you know, are we talking about in the mainstream media, has it perhaps become lost, or has it gone the way of oblivion? Maybe, but then we have to shift the frame. Right? I mean, and that's one of the things Edward was asking us to do, shift the frame. Like, something is radically absent in the dominant media, but where is it present? And what are the alternate medias that are making it present and which are producing a kind of counter-hegemonic resistance? Disrupt, say, the dominant media non-representation or reductive representation, either terrorist or absent. And I think, I guess that's one thing. The other point is that I think there are different forms of global solidarity. Some of them are focused on international law and its abrogations, and others are about resistance movements or allies among colonized people. I've noted as well that there's some really interesting connections between First World peoples and Palestinians on the question of indigeneity, how to think about self-rule, how to make the claim for self-rule, how not to replicate certain forms of state sovereignty people don't seem to like, but still honor ideas of political self-determination or self-rule. Those are live questions. Those are intense, important questions, and we can't think them alone. One can't think them alone. In this one moment where he's talking about Adorno, he says it's not possible. He's citing Adorno to the effect that no one can have a cogent thought without that thought being thought elsewhere. In other words, it has to be thought somewhere else in order for it to be cogent here. It can't just be my private thought. It has to be something someone else can think or has thought, or something I can think with others, which means not just within this framework, but in a comparative framework. And he was a comparative literature professor, right? And he made the case for comparative diasporas, and I think we could, on the basis of his work, also make a case for comparative genocide, which doesn't mean all genocides are the same, but it does mean that we have to develop those kinds of frameworks that are not just about thinking how these catastrophes happen in different times and spaces, but what kinds of alliances they foster, and even eventually or implicitly what kind of political solidarity that might lead to.
Yeah. today. I'm so sad today. I crossed the street to the fire station, but no one gave help the situation. Dreadful situation. I said they came over there.
All right, so I'm just going to add to that one thing, which is that neoliberalism has certainly arrived in Palestine in the sense that all those neoliberal metrics have entered into the non-governmental organizations who are helping to keep universities alive, who are helping to establish irrigation, who are working throughout the infrastructure, right? So one of the things that happens is that the infrastructure, of course, gets bombed or destroyed, and then the NGOs come in with their neoliberal metrics and rebuild it. And it's a cycle, right? And one of the problems with it is that you don't actually think about, well, what is it that is actually undermining the infrastructural conditions of Palestine systematically? What are those policies, and how has the Israeli state imposed them? And then but if we're only trying to ameliorate the effects through a certain and we can measure them according to neoliberal metrics, like people are functioning better or they're able to get to whatever their work site is if they have a work site or whatever that is, we're actually producing a kind of rationality that is complicit with the occupation, even though it's trying to ameliorate its effects. So neoliberalism has arrived. And it seems to me also to undercut these basic questions of self-determination, which I keep coming back to. What would it be to build those institutions in ways that the Palestinian people would like, and to have them sustainable on the basis of that population's desire?
The ones who sell the crack, or the planes they hijack, is it the campaigns that they act, or the land that they frack, another terror attack, another jewel in the sack, a mother torn from her pack, another form to send back, yeah.
Is it the greed that I lack, or something is holding us back? Is it my shade of black?
Plant a new tree, or stay in the city and show it perfectly. With so much pollution, can we find a solution? Submit to evolution, or start revolution? Thank you.
plus grass. Something is holding us back. Is it my shade of black? Is it my shade of black?
We're wrapping up.
Okay, sorry.
This is your last chance to be embarrassing, contrary,
no,
or
I've done
rude.
My
bit. Oh, yeah. But if there's any, just 1 minute, really, it's 8:30. If there's a final thought you'd like to share with us tonight before we leave.
Then here comes Edward. He is committed to a notion of the public. And there are some contenders, James Baldwin and Susan Sontag and some others. But Edward is committed to the public. But he arrives at a time when the neoliberal regime, which is in the early 70s, is becoming more popular and becomes hegemonic by the late 80s, by the mid-late 80s. even under conservative auspices of Reagan, it's still neoliberal in terms of being capitalist tied to those three tendencies. So he had to cut even more radically against the grain. When Du Bois invokes public and Dewey invokes public, people have a memory and a sense of the public. The New Deal was real. Deal was real. Deal was real. The Roosevelt did commit class suicide.
Did commit class suicide.
Did commit class suicide. Against his well-to-do Hyde Park friends.
But by the time you get to the 80s, the emotions of the public become more and more. Father removed from memory, from memory, from memory, from memory, from memory, from memory.
So he has to be even more heroic. And then he's Palestinian. Oh my God. I mean, the notion that the greatest public intellectual in American Empire in the latter part of the 20th century would be a Palestinian? Just think about that.
Just think about that.
But it's true.
It's true.
But as a Palestinian, he's just not every... Palestinian. He's somebody who is as highbrow, sophisticated, refined, creative, also has his limitations, but he's courageous, open-minded, self-critical, and willing to bear witness in such a way that 10 years later, we could come to the same spot that he lectured and wrestled with for 40 years and still be on fire like he was, because he was always on fire. I love that about Brother Edward. I love that about him. He brings tears to my eyes and just thinking about all this energy that he would dispense. How can he do so much in so little time?
So little time. So little time. So little time. So little time.
He didn't have computers in the same. And the flights took more hours. Think of the level of sacrifice that took. When he found out he had leukemia in September 1991, he didn't stop. His brother Messick was telling me that he saw Edward give a lecture in the afternoon after having chemotherapy that morning, and he had more energy he'd ever seen of any intellectual behind the lectern. That's the kind of commitment the brother had. Edward Zaire. We love you, Brother Edward. And we'll never forget you.
Okay.
You, Brother Edward.
We love you, Brother Edward.
We love you, Brother Edward.
We love you, Brother Edward.
And we'll never forget you.
We'll never forget you.
We'll never forget you.
L'Éternel est mon berger. Je ne manquerai de rien. Il me fait reposer dans de verts pâturages. Il me dirige près des eaux paisibles. Il restaure mon âme. Il me conduit dans les sentiers de la justice. À cause de son nom. Et quand je marche dans la vallée, dans l'ombre de la mort, je ne crains aucun mal, car tu es avec moi. Je ne crains aucun mal, car vous êtes avec moi. Baruch atah Adonai.
Baruch shema.
Baruch haba Yerushalayim. Adonai,
Baruch Shema,
Baruch Abba, Yerushalayim.
but to the Quran. Revelation in Jerusalem, Shalom. Salam Aleikum. You can see Christians, Jews and Muslims living together and praying, Amen. Let's give thanks and praises. Baruch Atah Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Baruch Atah Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Jerusalem, je t'aime, je t'aime, je t'aime.